Feroz Mehta speaks on karma and rebirth.
Some of the earliest immigrants into India in the Negrito and Proto-Australoid peoples who came from the Palestinian shore and from Africa had primitive beliefs about themselves. They believed in an indestructible life essence which at death went into the earth and reappeared in plants and in animals. If a pregnant woman ate of some plant or some animal which had this life essence, then that life essence reappeared in the child. Some such vague belief, primitive belief, was held by those people. You can see at once how this paved the way, ultimately, for the doctrine of reincarnation. These Negrito and Austroasiatic and Proto-Australoid people apparently came into India something like at least 7,000 years ago, 5,000 BC. They established the first village settlements, and their culture did not extend anything beyond just a very simple, primitive village culture as such. But they lived by the rule of law, that is to say, their tribal customs. Now, on this culture, which spread practically through the subcontinent, there came the impact about 2,000 years later of Sumerian and Armenian people, who were a highly civilized people. They were the first great city builders, and what we know as the Indus Valley civilization was their work. They didn't confine themselves to the Indo-Gangetic plain, but they went southwards also, spread right to the tip of the peninsula. They were a very virile people. They explored, they traveled right across through the daunting jungles of Burma into the extreme tip of Southeast Asia, as far as New Guinea and Papua. They built the cities, the first cities, and they had a sophisticated, civilized culture. What their religious beliefs were, we are not quite certain of, because their particular pictographic script has to this day not been deciphered. But they left lots of amulets and little signets and this, that and the other, and one of them particularly gives us a clue. It is the figure of Shiva in a meditative pose. If that were the case, they were acquainted with yoga as such. And if they represented one of their great gods in a meditative pose, and they had the concept of gods as such, they themselves must have realized the fruits of yoga to the nth degree. This fact we must bear in mind, because it plays a considerable part later on. in the history of India. After the Sumerian Armenian city builders came, and remember they came approximately at the time when the Kabbalah was the root tradition, the religious tradition of all the Semitic people. The Kabbalah antedates Abraham too. I won't go into all that because that would take up too much time. But it is a point to remember. After these people, there came the most important impact upon India. And this comes from the people whom we call the Aryan people who lived in the steppe lands of Central Asia. Something like 27 centuries before the birth of Christ, the people who lived in Mongolia and southern Siberia learned to tame the horse, and the amenability and the mobility of the horse gave horsemen a tremendous advantage over footmen. About 15 centuries before the birth of Christ, the Hittites of Anatolia discovered superior methods of smelting iron, and from that time onwards, the iron sword and dagger replaced the bronze sword and dagger, because the iron weapons were far more effective. These Aryan-speaking peoples were pastoral nomads. Almost every year they had to move 1,000 miles at least, if not more, from their own homes because they were driven by the climatic conditions. Ordinary midwinter temperatures at Tomsk and Krasnoyarsk of -2, -12, and Yakutsk registering -45. Comfortable for snowballing, but not for many other purposes, perhaps. And there came a time when there was probably a great drought, and they were driven southwards. Remember, those lands were semi-desert, arid lands, vast. And these people started their great migrations. These are the people whom we to this day call the Indo-European people. They migrated westwards into Greece, learned the arts of civilization from the Aegean civilization which prevailed there, and requited their teachers by practically exterminating them. Others went to Italy and became civilized through what they learned from the Etruscans, who in their turn were exterminated by these Aryans. Another lot came southwards. These are the people who entered Afghanistan, and at a place called Nishaya, they branched off in two directions. One went westwards into Iran and right into Azerbaijan. The other went eastwards across the Hindu Kush Mountains and the Suleiman Mountains, the passes of the Hindu Kush and Suleiman Mountains, into northwest India. And when they came into India, they entered a land which to them was like a land flowing with milk and honey, no drought, no difficulties where living conditions were concerned. Because remember that in those days, a good bit of all that part of India was heavily forested. And the warm winter rains and the fall of leaves century after century made for extreme fertility of the soil. And they had these great forest lands to supply them with wood and all the rest of it. Now these were a very fair-skinned race, tall, virile, vigorous, haughty, immensely proud of their superiority. Armed with horse and sword, naturally, they were conquerors. And they were the people who now brought in the third stage of development in India, establishing great kingdoms, Panchanada, Kurukshetra, Panchala, Kosala, Bhoja, Videha, Kashi, and Magadha. Some of these names, at least, you must know if you have read your Buddhism a little bit. And these kingdoms, remember, were approximately the size of the British Isles, or a little larger, spread right across the whole of northern India. It took them another 2,000 years to penetrate right down towards the south. Now, the Aryans brought with them the Rig Veda. This is a disputed point. Modern scholars, especially Indian scholars, jealous of their own culture, prefer to deny the Rig Veda coming from beyond in the bounds of India. They assert that the Rig Veda was composed in India. This may be the case, or it may not. It's not particularly important for us. I remember very well Professor Hutton and Professor Gordon Child both telling me how they believed that the Aryan-speaking people definitely came either from the steppe lands east of the Caspian, or, as Sir Gordon Child believed, from the Ukraine. And they did bring the Rig Veda with them. There are strong arguments against that idea too, but it doesn't matter where it came from. The point is that these Aryan-speaking peoples in India had the Rig Veda, which is the oldest religious monument of the entire Indo-European people and all their subsequent religious and philosophical culture. The Rig Veda has no mention whatsoever of rebirth, no doctrine of karma. Their doctrine was a straightforward heaven and hell. Either you live by the moral law, worship the gods, did all that was necessary, and enjoyed felicity in everlasting fellowship with the ancestors, the Pitris, as they call them, in heaven. And the one who went to heaven was the first mortal named Yama. Then, I have to run through this as swiftly as possible, because we've got to stride through the centuries in 50 minutes today. When they conquered, they were in the minority. And despite their haughtiness and fierceness, they had some extraordinary qualities. They were a race of poets to start with. They were an extremely tolerant people. And they were very good organizers. It's difficult to understand how pastoral nomads, when they conquered and established great kingdoms, could be good organizers. But this is a fact, an established fact. And they saw that various cultural groups prevailed in India, each following its own system. Therefore, in order to have a stable kingdom, they propounded this scheme to all the people under them. Each of you perform, live according to your own systems and ways of life and so forth. You may worship as you please, but you must perform your economic duties and pay allegiance to the Aryans as the head, so that we have a stable kingdom. And apparently they succeeded remarkably well with this approach and method. Now, amongst the conquered people, remember, were highly civilized people, highly developed people, people who knew yoga. And of course, there were the superstitious beliefs and the practice of magic, as they called it. There was also the degraded aspect, and there was also the highly developed aspect as such. Now, those amongst the Sumerian Armenian groups, and in the south, the Dravidians and so forth, they gradually, by interaction with their conquerors, persuaded them to accept them as priests. By mixing with the Aryans, the Brahmin caste arose. The Brahmin caste as such, in the beginning, was inferior to the rulers, the Rajanya. This is a very important point. Subsequently, the Brahmin caste gained ascendancy because they claimed the privilege, the exclusive privilege, of being in direct touch with the gods. And of course, the moment you bring this aspect into play, the power of the gods, the unknown, mysterious beings upon human life, then they hold the real reins of power. This on the external side. Internally, or I should say esoterically, of course, their religious practice had touched the peak. There was nothing that was lacking. Their great teaching, of course, was the teaching of Brahman and Atma. Two words they used for expressing the ultimate reality. Why two words? Because there are two fundamental questions man asks himself. What is ultimate reality? And the other question is, who am I? Attempting to answer the first question, which is an extrovert question, so to say, and an objective question, the answer was Brahman. Answering the other question, which is a subjective question, who am I? You go inwards to discover who I am. The answer was Atma. And remember that one of the meanings of the word Atma is eater up of the mind. Up from ad, meaning to eat, mind. It's a very interesting little point to bear in mind. Then they unequivocally affirmed the identity of Brahman and Atma. Now, of course, this has been one of the great stumbling blocks to all the theologies of the world other than the Upanishads. How on earth can you say that I am identical with the absolute ultimate being or reality? Because I am a separate creature. But the answer to me is a very simple one. I don't think you'll find it expounded anywhere. How does one arrive at the answers to such questions? First one sets out on the external road, inquiring outwardly what is ultimate reality. And before long, you are traversing all the depths of your own mind and your own states of consciousness till you arrive at the supreme communion, the emptiness, what the Buddha called the cessation. Answering the question, who am I, you look inward, and perhaps there is a certain degree of psychological analysis and so forth, and then all that subsides, and the other process, the denudation of the mind, the denudation of the mind of all concepts, ideas, beliefs, pictures, constructs and so forth proceeds, and you arrive at the same state. So, in obtaining the answers to the two questions, the denudation of the mind plays the most important part. And in this way, it was clearly realized by them that the particular individual and the totality are an identity. And this was one of the most extraordinary statements which ever came out of India, this identity of Brahman and Atma. This, of course, is expounded in the Upanishads. But prior to that exposition, which became more and more public, the people asked questions regarding social justice. How and why is it that I have to slave and be your servant and undergo this, that and the other? Why is it that I am ill and diseased and in pain and suffering, and you are enjoying this, that and the other and so forth? The Brahmin priest took a leaf out of the notebook of the beliefs of the ancient Proto-Australites and the Greeks and produced a theory of a succession of incarnations of the same person, of the individual. And they said, in a past life, you must have done so and so or so and so, and you are reaping the fruits of it now. But live a good life now and you'll have a better chance, you'll be in a better situation next time. This was the beginning of the spiritual rat race. But there was one truly unhappy aspect to this. When the great teaching of Brahman Atma was presented, Brahman or Atma, whichever term you like, was declared to be birthless, ageless, undecaying, deathless, unsorrowing, stainless. Now note carefully, if all that is said, it means that the Atma represents that which is completely outside the sphere of limitation of duality and multiplicity. But it is a sphere in which duality and multiplicity are all completely subsumed, because they are completely related to this, because this is the ultimate absolute source out of which the ramifications come. So in truth, the words Brahman and Atma represent the one that is the many. Its constitution is what you and I call the many. And the many are so completely interrelated to each other and to the whole that they are the one. And this one total reality is wholly embodied in every single particular that you and I are conscious of. This is one of the important things to bear in mind. But the misfortune came right. They began to talk in terms of my Atma. how can you appropriate the infinite, the immeasurable, the inconceivable, which is totally outside time and space, causation, substance, everything, every single category that we know of, totally outside. It is transcendent, and it is the absolute totality. Now, this was the misfortune which you find in some of the later Upanishads. But in the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads, particularly Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya, Taittiriya, you find the statement very, very clearly, birthless, ageless, undecaying, deathless, unstained, unsorrowing. It's all there. Exactly what the Buddha said when he spoke to his disciples and said, I saw the unborn, the unaging, the undying, the unstained, the unsorrowing. What did he see but the Atma? Now, the moment you came to this point of my Atma, then to square it up with their explanations to the general public, you were born in the past did this, that and the other, now you're reaping the fruits. See? In order to square it up with that, they propounded the jivatma. Jiva is life, you see. The jivatma, which they equated with what we would in English call the reincarnating ego. You see? That's how this came about. The reincarnating ego. But obviously the thing is false if you look at it clearly. You cannot have a jiva-atma which is a separate, identifiable entity. Because whatsoever is a separate, identifiable entity is not free of birth, of aging, of decaying, of dying. It's very important to bear this in mind. But the mass of people are not capable of seeing through into this. They are not capable of being free of a clinging to ego, a clinging to personal survival. They can't bear the thought that I shall completely disappear. Yes, why not? If one is concerned with that, one might ask the other question, is there any reason why I should appear? A separate I? What a conceit. All right, let's go on. So, associated therefore with this idea of the rebirth of an entity self, remember, an identifiable entity, which necessarily is perishing and cannot be an immortal jivatma popping from body to body, life after life. It just cannot. They also propounded karma as a credit-debit ledger account. Well, this is precisely what people, this is what you, what do you yourself believe when you say karma? You see, the sad part is this. Analogically, we carry over from our limited physical experience our ideas which apply in this limited context to the transcendent, and they don't apply there in that context. just as the laws of causality don't apply in the subatomic world. And science has discovered that today. Causality doesn't hold good there. But we'll come to that a little later. So now, this idea of rebirth, of a particular reincarnating ego, a jiva-atma, as a permanent entity, remember, permanent, changeless entity, is what is called punar-janma. Punar, again, birth. Janma, as meaning birth, literally means birth as we know it as a physical phenomenon, the emerging out of your mother's body, that birth. This is punar-janma. So we go on, as they said, life after life. And this faring on life after life is called samsara. Now contrast with that idea, the popular misconception of the facts, contrast with that what is taught and openly disclosed in the Maitri and the Shandilya Upanishad. In the Maitri Upanishad, it is very clearly stated, samsara is just one's own thought. It is your thought process which is samsara. Relate this to the Buddha's paticca samuppada. The paticca samuppada of the Buddha presents the analyzed rationale of your thought process. It does not involve past lives and future lives and all that. The scholastic has made a mess of the whole thing. What was the Buddha concerned with? The mind. He was a mind healer. If I had no mind at all, there'd be no samsara. It is my mode of awareness and all my strange identifications of a postulated I am I with all these different states of mind, which is samsara. The world process is not samsara. The physical universal process is samsara. It is all in the mind. It is how you and I look at it. Look at it not with our eyes, but with our conditioned mind. And because of ignorance and especially tanha, the thirst for sentient existence, we make all our mistakes with regard to our conception of how things go on. And it is all this which produces our samsara. Now, the Maitri Upanishad said, samsara is just one's own thought. The wise man should purify that, and he is free of the round of births and deaths. The Shandilya Upanishad reiterates the same statement, and the Shandilya Upanishad is one of the great yoga Upanishads. If you want to study the original teachings about yoga, look into the Shandilya as one of the important yoga Upanishads. These are not very well known, unfortunately. The Shandilya Upanishad says precisely the same thing. Samsara is just the fluctuations of your own mind, the thought process. When the fluctuations cease, samsara, the round of births and deaths, has come to an end. Because it is in your own mind, by self-association with a particular state, that you are born in that state. you go through in your mind your experience. And when it comes to an end, by self-association, I have died with the end of the mental procedure, the mental event. This is the real samsara, the cycle of birth and death, the circle, which goes on and on and on and on from the time you are born till the time you die. When you die, there is the complete cessation of all psychophysicality. What goes on? You say, oh, it's an energy. Have you ever been able to capture energy by itself and hold it separately and say, this energy was the energy which did so and so? Not at all. There is no such thing as energy possible for us to grasp and understand apart from its physical apparatus, its physical root. Energy itself is the unknown, mysterious thing, the absolute. That is what energy is. It has no dimensions, no length, no breadth, etc., etc. The ancient people used the word spirit for that. They said it's the eternal spirit. We use the word energy today, and it is easier for us to understand these things, because we have learned a little bit about how to canalize energy and bend it to our will, electrical energy or heat or light or other energy and so forth. Now, there is this mind energy also. That is to say, mind is one of the manifestations of energy. Energy in its absolute nature no one knows, and no one can know. You see? So, when the fluctuations of the mind cease, that's the end of samsara, the end of the round of birth and death. The Buddha, for example, says time and again, he has a prison in Nibbana, never to come back again. He uses the identical terms of the Upanishads. Only the Upanishads don't say he has a prison in Nirvana, but that he has become Brahman, or that he has realized the Atma. And therefore he never comes back again. Back into this consciousness which is tossed about on the ocean of samsara, which is your mind process, the mind disturbances. Now, let us consider some words of Sri Krishna. You all think of Sri Krishna as the great teacher in the Gita, the one who is called Bhagwan, God incarnate, teaching a disciple Arjuna. I say to you that there was not a Krishna and an Arjuna who were two separate people. Who wrote the Gita? Krishna Dvaipayana Vedavyasa, that was his full name. Here was a man who realize the state of supreme communion. When one returns from the state of supreme communion, one tends to utilize the divine dialogue as a convenient form in which to convey teachings. The Old Testament prophets, you find it in the Zarathustrian writings, you find it in the Hindu writings. You find it in minor ways when when it is said, oh, that such and such a deva appeared, or an archangel, or an angel, the angel of the presence appeared and said unto me. Who is this angel of the presence? It is you yourself. Your own awareness of transcendent reality, which has to be sort of given limited form, so you give it an exalted form, and then it conveys a divine message to you. But it is your own inner realization. So this poet who wrote the Gita himself is Krishna, the teacher. Himself is Arjuna, every man, the man in the world, the disciple. I wish I had picked out that verse. There is a verse in the Gita in which he gives out the secret. Of the sons of Vrishni, I am Krishna. Of the sons of Pandu, I am Arjuna. Of poets, I am the bard Ushana. Amongst something, I've forgotten the word, he says, I am Vyasa, his own servant. It means the arranger. That one verse gives out the secret, if one knows how to penetrate into it and interpret it. How can the same man be Krishna of the Vrishnis and also Arjuna, who was reputed the son of Pandu, and also be the bard Ushana, who flourished in the Vedic times? You see the significance of it. So he is the one who is giving the teaching. What does he say, amongst other things, about himself? The indestructible, unmanifest is my abode. And he also says, I am the abode of the indestructible, unmanifest. How can the two be true? Either he is the abode of the indestructible unmanifest, or he is living in the indestructible unmanifest as the abode. You remember we talked a bit about the identity of the container and the contained yesterday. I said a few words about it. Now, Krishna also says, I am life immortal and also death, being and non-being am I, O Arjuna. I am life immortal and also death, being and non-being. Now consider carefully. Non-being, no characteristics at all, is a one universal characterless, amorphous state, is it not? That's non-being. Non-being is necessarily one. But that, out of that non-being, there emerge countless millions of beings, separate finite objects. Non-being is the infinite. Being is the finite. Non-being knows no birth or death or any such thing. Beings know it. So beings emerge out of the one non-being, and into non-being they return at death. But what does that return imply? When the whole psychophysical organism disintegrates, it is totally gone. Look at the Buddhist analysis. Here is the psychophysical being. Rupa, Vedna, Sanya, Sankhara, Vinyana. Every one of them perishes. And they are all here not as separate things mechanically synthesized together, but as an integrated whole organism. If any one aspect is out, the whole lot is out. These are very important points to bear in mind. You see? So, the being, returning to non-being, means that identifiable entity has absolutely disappeared. I am I. Now, the Buddha also teaches this. I am coming to the Buddha now to support what Krishna said. A is not equal to A, the Greco-Roman law of identity. A equals A. The Buddha said that is incorrect. A equals A becoming A1. A1 equals A1 becoming A2, and so on. Then the Buddhist theory goes on that we see that there is this continuity, individuality perhaps in some form or other persists, and so forth. And we grow. Now the mistake is in saying we grow. Because in the becoming process, from split second to split second, in that becoming process, identity, identifiable identity is gone. Consider what we have learned about the nature of matter in our own time. We take the atom, and we say that the atom is composed. The atoms of the different elements, of course, are distinguishable from each other as atoms of sulfur, of uranium, or iron, or phosphorus, or whatever it may be. But when you go into the atomic world and you get your electrons, protons, neutrons, and a whole lot of ions like that, you see, and they are completely indistinguishable from any other electron or proton, whatever chemical element they came from. Identity is lost. You can't put a label on them. Take that still further and let the disintegration be complete and total. What happens? As with an atomic explosion, matter has completely disappeared and become energy, the thing you can't touch, you can't see, etc. It does itself in some mysterious way, given its physical apparatus, will manifest as electricity, or as heat, or as light, etc. But this identifiable entity completely disappears. This is the point to bear in mind. An identifiable entity spells ego, and the ego concept, I am not you. And with that ego concept is associated the idea of permanency. You can't get rid of it. Now obviously this is false. This is our misconcept. It is associated with our fear of annihilation. But it was clearly taught by the Buddha particularly, there is no such thing as annihilation. The Upanishads taught also, there is no such thing as annihilation. But how simple the truth is. Look, if there is just one total reality, infinite, immeasurable, can it become more? Can it become less? Can you add to it? Can you subtract from it? Can you multiply it? Can you divide it? You can't. You see, if you have ever been touched with this transcendence, somehow or other, realize this emptying of the mind, so that the mind has at last become a true transparency, you suddenly wake up to the nature of the one total reality. And you will see that all these unhappy little doctrines, which are all self-oriented, which is the root of suffering and sorrow, self-orientation, all these unhappy doctrines must necessarily go. If you want truth, and the truth sets you free, you have no idea of the extraordinary liberation that comes and the peace that comes when you let go. You cease to grasp ideas. Look, what did the Buddha say? to Kachana, one of his great disciples, grasping after systems, imprisoned by dogmas, is this world, Kachayana, for the most part. And the man who does not go after that system grasping, that mental standpoint, that dogmatic bias, who does not grasp at it, does not take up his stand upon it, does not think, it is my soul, permanent entity, who thinks that which arises is just ill, that which passes away is ill. This man is not in doubt, is not perplexed. Knowledge herein is his, that is not merely another. Thus far, Kachayana, he has right understanding. Why did the Buddha say, don't grasp at sannyā, sankhāra, viññāna, or anything at all? Now you can, another saying then of Krishna, all consuming death am I, and the source of all things to come. When Krishna says I, therefore, what is the meaning of that word I, aham? The Buddha uses the word aham constantly. And especially considering that the Buddhist analysis completely gives the K.O. to I, a proper knock out to I, why is it that the enlightened one himself is constantly using the word I, and very emphatically, but I, O Ananda, or I, O Kachana, etc., etc. What is the meaning of this aha? Now look, understand how this aham came to mean what it means in the original scriptures. I mentioned Brahman and Atman, objective and subjective terms. The term used as far as manifestation, total manifestation is concerned, the term used Atma, because it is associated with the fact that all manifestation emerges out of consciousness. In the ultimate, the Upanishad states, Atma is pure consciousness. Now consciousness is a very bad word, very difficult word. What is consciousness? You are conscious of this, that, or the other. You are unconscious of this, that, or the other. But what on earth is consciousness? You see? Now, supposing Brahman were to say, I, that is the meaning of the word Atma. It subjectivizes the one total reality. And in this subjectivization, the word I is total and absolute. There are no separate entities in this I. One like the Buddha, who had realized the supreme communion in the cessation, and so forth, you see, who had become completely enlightened. Do you think that he used the word I, meaning Siddhartha Gautama, town Kapilavastu? No. This I, the totality is speaking. Transcendence itself is speaking through the mouth of the Holy One. It is in this sense that they use the word aham, the great Holy One, all of them. And I, in that sense, is the unabandonable. You can't abandon. Because if your awareness is at one with the total reality is conscious through you, then it cannot be separate identity at all. There is no separate ego involved. It is the absolute all. What does the Lord God say to Moses in Exodus? If the Israelites ask me, who hath sent you? Say unto them, Ehiyeh Asher Ehiyeh. I am that I am, the one and only I am, the living reality. The total reality is not just a collection of objects. It is a living reality. It is really indescribable. So, the word Aham is used. Let us revert for a while to the Buddhist presentation, A equals A becoming A1, A1 equals A1 becoming A2. Now, when we say A, what do we mean? Just any particular separate object or entity? That is what we usually mean, is it not? But take any person. This fellow is called John Smith, that fellow is called William Brown. All right. Is John Smith just John Smith? Does he end with his skin? What about the air he breathed in and then breathed out? When John Smith breathes out, does a little bit of John Smith this become John Smith? But if so, has it still got any identity with John Smith? But it was part of him when he breathed it in, wasn't it? Wasn't it? If you eat food, that food which was not you is now inside you, part of you. It undergoes a process of digestion, transformation inside. Some of it is assimilated, and you might be inclined to think, well, it has become me now. And a part of it is rejected. Then that which was inside and part of you on rejection, does it sort of this become you? Or is it still you in some mysterious way? Consider it a little more deeply. Here I say, I am. And I say, you are. The self and the not self. All the rest is dumped as not self. But could I subsist, exist for a single fraction of a moment if the not self were absent, totally absent? If the existence of this self is so dependent upon everything else, light, air, warmth, people, things, etc., 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 then what is the meaning of this self? Is it not inclusive of the totality? You see, you can never escape this totality. You can't be thrown out of the cosmos. See? So if you are integral part and parcel of the cosmos to that extent, and yet there is the phenomenon of the complete disintegration of a particular patterning of the cosmos, which returns into non-being, the characterless, absolute, indistinguishable totality, then oneself and the totality are one and the same thing. So when I say the word I, the only real meaning to the word I is the totality. This is the I am. The Ehiye Asher Ehiye of Exodus, the Aham of the great holy ones of India. This is the meaning of it. Now, if that is the case, how can there be any such thing as I was born in the past, I am born now, I will be born in the future. There is this process of going on of change and transformation, of course. If we were to say, Brahman, the Absolute, or the Lord, if you like to use the term, is the one and only transmigrant, yes, that is not so misleading, because all these changes take place in the One. Now notice the characteristics of the wonderful things about this one total reality. As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. Wheresoever you turn your gaze, you will find things at different stages. Take human beings. At this moment, we'll say every 2 seconds or 3 seconds, is it, two babies are born. So birth is taking place. This very moment, there are some who are older, some who are maturing, some who are dying, and everything is happening simultaneously. This is the meaning of totality. It is not. Feel it out. This totality, everything is happening. There a galaxy is just coming into being. There a galaxy is just dying. You see, in the state of supreme communion, you are not aware analytically, consciously, but that awareness is an awareness which is the supreme, total, absolute activity of the universe, and at the same time is utterly at peace. As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. That doesn't mean something static, that it won't change and won't move. I have suggested how one may understand this. So now, in this process, identifiable entity has no room at all. And therefore it's never a case of I being reborn, or I having a past life. This total process goes on like that. Now try and picture yourself as the totality. Let's have a daytime in imagining ourselves as absolute God. In Him we live and move and have our being. All right. If we are God, in God everything lives and moves and has its being. God, the immortal, the undying, the unaging, unsorrowing. Now, feel it out. You can do it right now. Feel it out. All that you and I, with our limited perception, see as change and development and growth and all the rest of it, is simultaneously present in you, God. That's that. This is the meaning of eternity, of immortality. Non-mortal. And yet, within eternity is unidirectional time, because you and I are conscious in that way. But God is conscious in totality of time, in all the dimensions of time simultaneously. That's eternity. And similarly with space. And it is an integrated space-time, and immensely more than that, because the mind of this poor mortal can never grasp the immensely more. It can grasp only this far and no more, what I'm trying to put before you. now, you see, if you really understand this, how easy it is not to grasp. Why do we grasp anything? Because we are afraid we might be without something which is necessary or which we without. You'll be free of fear. All right. So now, we have already touched upon this. The samsara of any one person, as we ordinarily talk, is, or we'll say, samsara, is in actual fact the world's samsara, the Weltschmerz, perhaps. Hence the Buddha's statement, Sam Bhikkhu, tread the Brahma path for making, listen carefully, a complete end of all ills. Now you get the significance and the full force of it. If you think in terms of my ill and, the ill of my friends, or even the ill of all humanity and so forth, you see, of all living creatures, we are still in the realm of the finite and the particular. But a complete end of all fear is the utter transformation in your own awareness through utter purity, complete attentiveness and communion. You see, it's so difficult for us poor mortals to reach anywhere near what the Holy Ones tried to give out and convey. Because they gave in universal measure, from a universal level, a transcendent level. And it's like a cornucopia which will never empty, and it is just pouring out, and all we can do is to take a tiny little cup. That's why it's so difficult to get at these things. Now let us look at some of the statements which we find in the scriptures. Buddha looks into his, as the translations go, into his past habitation, the Pubbe Nivasa, past habitation. And of course it's immediately interpreted as past life. But if you look at the descriptions of those past lives, it's the most piffling nonsense that you ever saw. All he says is, I was born here, I wore these clothes, I ate that food, then I died, then I passed on, I was born here, I wore these clothes, I ate this food. Good gracious me, does it need any enlightened holy one to look into all that sort of people? Who's interested in that? What has that got to do with religion and the holy life? And it is always, you know, in India. The way it is forgiven. A very strange thing. Supposing the Buddha had been a Red Indian and looked into his past. I was born here, I had such and such a tomahawk, and I wore such and such feathers, and I slew such and such enemies. And the thing will repeat itself endlessly, all in terms of the Red Indian. Yeah? Isn't it a complete absurdity? Now look at it this way. The Pubbe Nivasa. What can we legitimately say is the dweller? Your self-consciousness. Is it not? in the different states of mind. Now, half an hour ago, yesterday, a week ago, a year ago, 10 years ago, etc., etc., etc. The different states of mind and how the whole thing is linked up. Now don't say, oh yes, this is just the association technique of the psychologist. That's a very naive and facile way of getting out of it. Your psychologist is one who has not realized the undefiled state. What does the Buddha do after the Enlightenment? It is said that he stares for 7 days at the roots of the tree under which he sat. Good heavens, the Holy One, even if he had botanical interest, is he going to do it? Is he going to spend 7 days staring at the roots of a tree? I mean, at least if he does go make some sort of investigation, one may understand. Stand there and stare at the root of a tree for 7 days. Must be not. Not enlightened. The tree is this, the brain, the spine, the nervous system, the whole state of the mind. Here at last was a man who was able to say, utterly pure is my mind, is the mind, utterly free of every defilement, every stain. He was able to say that. Not liable to delusion. This was a new phenomenon. This is something unknown to the world. And this is what the Buddha realized. And in the fourth jhana, he looks back with the mind pliable, pure, completely clean. Now he examines the past states which led up to the final illumination. And he sees the link. It is because of this that he knows how to teach his disciples to purify the mind. This is the value of it. Otherwise, there's no historical or any other value to looking back into the past. Then he knows, thus and thus the mind was, and therefore such and such is the consequence of it. All right. Now, the Buddha never talks of punarjanma, which the Hindus who postulated the reincarnating ego talked of, you see. My Atma coming back, which is a complete absurdity. Because the term my Atma is self-contradictory. The Buddha spoke of Punabhava and again becoming. He presented it in much better form. Punabhava. What is this again becoming? Consider the actual process. What happens? Here at this moment is this particular condition. Such are the forces operating inwardly from within yourself and all the stimuli from outside. And from split second to split second, there is a transforming process going on all the time. This is what he was trying to put forward. You know, in our own age, Lloyd Morgan has produced a philosophy called emergent evolution. Those of you who are interested in such things can refer to what he said. But the Buddha wasn't talking of emergent evolution, but there is a certain relationship there. All the time, this living universal process means a continuous emergence, an emergence through a transformative process, transformative, not transmutative, yes, a transformative process. And this is the real Punna Bhava, the again becoming. And you can influence this Punna Bhava by directing your own attention and your own energy towards the goal of complete fulfillment. Because only man has this power of beginning. Your animals haven't got it, or your plants. Like relationship to Aristotle's entelechy and all that. But don't get diverse into that. Now, so Punna Bhava is not reincarnation. Incarnation implies identifiable entity, whatever that entity may be. A jivatma or karaka or energy or something. You can't isolate it and make it stand out and stay put. It's continuously changing. It will not stop changing. Right. So now, what does karma mean? Here we come to something very, very wonderful, believe me. Derived from the root kri. In the dictionary you will find it stated to do, to make. But kri, the root, means really to create. Now be very careful, creation is not a putting together, a sankata, in order to produce a sankhara. A put together is a mechanical process of already existing elements. Take the pieces and put them together, and there you've made something, you see. Creation is something utterly different. I mentioned energy, which we don't know. Energy is creative power, and creative power cannot be dissociated from continuously acting creative power. Krishna says, if I did not constantly engage in action, these worlds would fall into ruin. When action is karma, he uses the word uses karma. If I did not engage in constant action, these worlds would fall into ruin. And action is creative action. Is the creative power at work? This creative power, which is a total mystery to us, and in its working, it is utterly atonal, it's amoral. It is discontinuous, it is non-repetitive, and it is transmutative. The Lord doesn't suffer from the effects of his creation. You can't charge him at the bar and say he accused. Quite impossible. It's absolutely free. Intensely creative energy. Now, one of the remarkable things that has happened in the last few years in the scientific world is this. The integration of Einsteinian relativity with quantum mechanics has given rise to a totally new and vital perception of the nature of what we call matter. Every single particle, I have to use the word particle because it is easy to understand, but particles are not particles in the atomic realm, and still less in the subatomic realm, you see. Every single one throws out a virtual, what they call a virtual particle, and immediately reabsorbs it. Samsara. It is a living process. So in terms of this scientific view, for which Dr. Jeffrey Chu of California, or is principally responsible. It's called the S-matrix theory. We'll forget that name, it's not important for us. He states that the mathematics of it works out to something like this, that this pulse of creation, because all matter is not, no matter is dead matter, no particle is dead. This pulse of creation vibrates at the rate of something like 10 to the power 23 times a second. 100,000,000,000,000,000 times a second. Now, the Holy Ones in the Supreme Communion are in tune with this creative power. Because God is not a person with or without a beard or anything. In this Unio Mystica, in this Supreme Communion, one is completely in tune with this pulse of creation. It goes on with incredible rapidity, as we would say. But as I mentioned a few moments ago, the extraordinary thing about this discontinuous pulse is just this, that every creation is utterly new. It is not a reshuffling of the old material. It is not a transformation in the sense in which we mean transformation, but it is a true transmutation. It is not related to any known past. It has no future to deal with. It is absolute. This being in communion like that makes an impress upon the psychophysical organism of the Holy One. When he back is ordinary sense, discursive mind consciousness, how is he to convey this? Remember that in those days, unlike our modern 20th century, they did not know transmutation, they did not know integration as we know. They knew transformation. They didn't have that knowledge of the nature of the physical, what we call the physical universe as such, to be able to produce these extra concepts which help us to get a little nearer the reality and discard our old views. So the old people had to present it in terms of a continuity, not a discontinuity. This was one of their great difficulties. So the two forms in which their experience was conveyed took the shape of karma as causality, as a causal law operating, and as rebirth. This was their difficulty. But they knew the Buddha came was the one who was able to formulate it in the least misleading terms. I lay my head on the block before the Buddha for talking about him like that. But we can understand this a little more clearly now. And in this understanding, we will see that the whole rebirth belief is a belief which the populace has held through the ages, but it is a very inadequate and a misleading picture of this supreme reality. the pulse of creation at work. And karma as a ledger account, oh for goodness sake, get rid of it completely. Because there is nothing which you or I can think, feel, speak or do which is done exclusively by you or me. When you say, oh, I had an idea and I thought so and so. Now it is not you alone who had the idea. So many influences from everywhere around. Your whole past culture and everything produced the idea. The chatter around you in the pub when you were having the eighth beer and so forth. You see, all that has played its part and it has emerged through you as the apparatus, the receiving apparatus, and found expression. And it will also have emerged in 100 other people as the receiving apparatus and found expression. There is nothing then which I can point to and say, I thought this, I did that, or you thought this, you did that. The totality thought it, the totality did it. Look, you can really get this. Be released from this ghastly bondage to the egoistic misconception of what oneself is. If you can do that, then the reality of all life is one. That we are all brethren in a profound and a wonderful sense will naturally emerge in you, and you will naturally be compassionate. You will naturally be all that is representative of the perfect human. People will say, oh, but if you throw aside heaven, hell, immortality, perfection, reaching the goal of nirvana, etc., etc., people will become wild. Not at all. If you truly understand the imperative necessity for sila will become immensely greater. You can't put it right tomorrow or day after. Now. Here and now. It has to be absolutely perfect, every single moment. See, in the Buddha himself says, summon up your energy. Keep going without lagging. That's how I translate it, not work out your salvation with diligence. Keep going without lagging. And then you will find that you are the very sun of S-U-N, sun of compassion and wisdom, and you'll be a blessing and a benediction to the world in which you live.